Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is Rick Rosoff. Rick has been on before. He's founder and editor of what I call an invaluable website, Stop NATO. Everybody should follow Stop NATO on a daily basis. Important information about what I call NATO's killing machine, and that's exactly what it is. And Rick does incredible research, getting up important information that he's passing on to people who use the website on a regular basis. I check it every single day to see what Rick has put up and occasionally use some of the information when it coincides with something that I'm writing about. Again, Rick's what Rick does is absolutely invaluable in putting in just important time and effort into his initiative, and has been doing it for many, many years. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Stephen, and it's so great to have you back, and thank you for your generous words.
Oh, Rick, I mean every bit of it, and we certainly want to talk about some of the things that you feature all the time, the situation in Ukraine. I began an article. I've devoted a lot of time in the run-up to the U.S. election and the day after the election, and again this morning, writing about what went on and the fraudulent process in America. But I always go back to Ukraine again, depending on what's happening, and I began an article that I call Kiev Wants War, not peace. And it certainly looks that way from the things that are going on in southeastern Ukraine.
Yeah, there's a tank battle right now, reportedly, in the city of Donetsk near the airport that is armored vehicles, tanks, and others by the U.S. proxy regime in Kiev, that of Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk, are still assaulting. The war is in its, by my count, 206th day today. There's 206 days of warfare in Europe. It is transparently, of course, a proxy or a surrogate effort by the United States and NATO. The regime that holds power, the titular regime in Kiev, of course, is that appointed and effectively installed by Victoria Nuland in the State Department. And when you mentioned the elections, your first article on the the pseudo elections in the United States was very, very good. I mean, let's be honest about it: the 435 members of Congress, all of whom were elected or reelected 2 days ago. And for the 100 members of the Senate, I think 36 of whom are elected or reelected 2 days ago, they vote in lockstep, in tandem, especially on foreign policy issues. There's no distinction at all. If tomorrow Obama declares war against Russia, nuclear war against Russia, he can be assured of 535 votes on both sides of on Capitol Hill. And this is the pseudo-democracy that presumes to dictate its method to the rest of the world, oftentimes at sword's point.
Rick, I absolutely agree with you, including so-called progressive Democrats. We'll vote for all of the defense authorization budgets. We'll vote for indefinite detentions. We'll vote for nuclear war against Russia if it came up. These are the kind of people running America, and I agree with you. Right down the line, they'll cite U.S. security and the need to support the homeland and all that garbage, and 535 in lockstep will vote for what 535 should have voted against.
Yeah, right you are. The last two, dissident voices, if you will, both left after the last session of Congress, those being Dennis Kucinich on one side of the aisle and Ron Paul on the other, so that they do have this appalling unanimity that we're talking about. And this is, this is the nature of, and we also have to recall, living in Chicago, I don't know how many of your listeners outside the city are aware of this, that the same political party has had the chief executive, the mayor, for 83 years uninterrupted. That all 50 members of the legislative branch, the city council, though not compelled to acknowledge their political affiliations, are members of that same party.
Rick, so I think the last Republican was a guy named Thompson.
William Hale Thompson. He stepped down in 1931. So for 83 years, and then we've had not only one-party rule, a dictatorship in this city, but we've had hereditary leaders for life. With Richard Daley first,
absolutely.
Meaning to pass the baton on to his son, who had to wait a few years before he picked it up, but nevertheless, stayed in there until health problems in his family necessitated stepping down. But in theory, it always amazes me, by the way, that Hillary Clinton, who was born roughly a mile from where I'm speaking to you from, my apartment on the north side of Chicago at the former Edgewater Hospital, had the temerity while Secretary of State to dress down governments in countries like Syria and North Korea, when her own hometown certainly didn't offer any better model.
That's exactly right. I think there was one race where a Republican actually made a decent showing.
Because of racism. That was Bernie Upton in the 1983
election. That's right, Bernie Upton.
The entire Democratic Party political leadership, at that time Edward Verdoliak was chairman both of the Cook County and the City of Chicago Democratic Party, collaborated with the Ronald Reagan administration surreptitiously, supported the Republican candidate, Bernard Upton, because the Democratic nominee, he who won the three-way primary election, was African-American. So the entire political leadership of the Democratic Party worked for a Republican based on racist motives.
You're talking about Harold Washington?
That's correct. I had the honor to work for and to know, and I think was probably the last great populist political prospect we had.
A guy who did not take good care of himself health-wise, and he died much too young.
That he did.
Indeed, I remember him, Rick. Indeed, I remember, and I agree with you about Chicago. If there ever was a municipal dictatorship, Chicago is.
Yeah, and I only bring that up because, of course, Chicago is now the White House. No, Barack Obama is a graduate of the Chicago political machine. His first chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, likewise is now the mayor of Chicago. His predecessor, Richard Daley's brother, William Daley, then replaced Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff of the White House, and so forth. And many of Valerie Jarrett and other key aides, David Axelrod, are all Chicagoans. Products of the Chicago political system. So for them, to set themselves up as a model of democracy for the rest of the world is, paradoxical to say the least. It's really quite repugnant. But nevertheless, I didn't mean to sidetrack on that. But we should also recall, of course, that when the so-called Orange Revolution occurred in Ukraine, to get back to topic, in 2004, that the wife of the U.S. appointee at that time, to be head of state, Viktor Yushchenko, is Catherine Yushchenko, born in the United States, in Ukrainian village. Went to the University of Chicago, was in the Treasury Department, the State Department, and the White House during the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush administration. So Chicago is, in a way, is attempting to redefine world politics according to its own corrupt and dictatorial method.
Well, indeed, Rick, I think talking about Chicago is important because it's a microcosm of the way America is run. It's a little bit more blatant the way a family can dominate politics for four decades, but basically, it's the same kind of system on a smaller scale. And I remember Time Magazine calling, Daley Jr., America's mayor. I hope I'm getting the language right, but they wrote an article about Daley Jr., putting him on the cover and calling him America's mayor. And I wrote about it some years ago. But this is the kind of system, of course, it translates to the way America's run, with Horace, with Obama pursuing all the policies no responsible leader should get anywhere near, including all of the wars that have gone on every single day during his tenure, responsible for all of them, the Iraq War III, the continuing conflict in Afghanistan, that will continue after U.S. troops draw down to 10,000 or so, the situation in Syria that I call Obama's war, and, of course, everything that's going on in Ukraine.
No, you're correct that we could throw Libya into the equation.
Oh, Libya, of course.
And then the ongoing proxy wars, in essence, in Somalia and Yemen. It's still, and people aren't aware of it, counterinsurgency wars the U.S. is not only supporting, but really leading in nations like Colombia, Philippines, Kurdistan, and Turkey, and other parts of the world, Palestine. And we had occasion to quote the pontiff, if you recall, last time we spoke about there being, in essence, a piecemeal or an ongoing third world war. And indeed, that's exactly what has transpired. This is the 25th anniversary, of course, of the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yes.
At which point, the overly optimistic members, the kind of millenarian or lotus eaters who believe that, both sides were wrong and the other side was predominantly wrong because they weren't us. Talk about national narcissism, and that it was such an unalloyed blessing to the world that the Soviet Union disappeared and the socialist bloc, and that look how great things have been in the interim, right? That people had all sorts of roseate dreams of what the world is going to be like. And, of course, they were all crashed immediately because, 1991, the U.S. waged, by the way, it's a good characterization of the ongoing proxy war, a direct war in Iraq is Iraq 3. I would never have thought of that. But Iraq 1 in 1991, we have to remember the speech by George H.W. Bush at the beginning of that year where he used the term New World Order, and he, initiated it. He launched it. That's exactly what that war was about, to serve notice to the world that there's now a unipolar world system. There's now a world sole military superpower. And I repeat that, frequently, but that's Obama's statement, by the way, characterization of the United States on the occasion of his receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. And that, everything that has succeeded, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, far from creating a peaceful or a just or an equitable world, has done quite the opposite. And what it's done is allowed an uncontested, predatory, rapacious power, and you know who we're talking about, to run rampant throughout the world with very few consequences.
Rick, there was a report today on RT International about the 25th anniversary saying that a fair number of people in Germany really would like to go back to the old days, put the wall back up again, and make it 10 meters higher than it was before, go back to the old system because the new one is so wretched, just exploiting people, taking advantage of them, doing so much harm, and things weren't perfect, far from perfect, back in the old days. They certainly weren't the good old days, but people are actually looking back at those days with nostalgia.
Not surprisingly, one thing you can say about, the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, was their soldiers were never called upon to go fight, kill, and die in wars during the period where they were socialist-oriented and were a member of Comecon and the Warsaw Pact. They are now. Starting in 1999, the then so-called red-green government, the ability of the world to say these things with a straight face is astonishing. That is that of Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and Foreign Minister of the Green Party, Joschka Fischer, brought Germany back into the war business again by bombing, supplying warplanes for the war against Yugoslavia, and what was essentially a reprise of Nazi Germany's attack on Belgrade and Yugoslavia in 1941, and then immediately afterwards sending ground troops into Afghanistan to wage a ground war in Europe, something Hitler could have dreamt of. Schroeder and Herr Fischer managed to arrange that under NATO auspices. So I can see, if I'm living in the more impoverished, neglected, marginalized eastern part of Germany right now, Federal Republic of Germany, I'm saying at least, my sons and daughters weren't, sent over to fight and die in foreign wars.
Oh, indeed, Rick. I've only been to Europe one time in the late 1970s, and I happened to have been in Berlin, and I went through Checkpoint Charlie into East Berlin. I didn't spend enough time there. I took a bus tour, but I managed to sit beside the woman who was explaining things to people. A very nice woman. And when she wasn't explaining things, we chatted a little bit about things going on. She seemed very content with her life there. I mean, she seemed very genuine about how she felt. And only being there a short time. And, seeing the things they wanted us to see, really we didn't get a chance to do much of anything, spending an hour and 90 minutes or whatever. But at least it gave me a slight taste of the flavor of what went on. And the only thing I can remember now was there was sort of a serene calm about things going on. I saw nothing that would have bothered me had I lived there. But again, in 90 minutes, you really can't tell anything. But at least I was able to go there once.
Yeah, and Stephen, it's, as I was remarking, the Soviet Union was involved in the war in Afghanistan from 1979 until their withdrawal in 1992. At no point did they levy, troop demands on Warsaw Pact countries to supply troops. However, there's an article just yesterday in the Pentagon's website, the Department of Defense website, where the number two, NATO's Deputy Secretary General, who's an American, of course, he always is, in this case, Alexander Verzbau, who was formerly, by the way, U.S. Ambassador to Russia not too long ago, and is really, the power behind the throne. To believe that Jens Stoltenberg the Dane who preceded him, really had any power. This is a guy calling the shots, Rasmussen. And what he said a number of things. One of the things he said at the Wales summit recently of NATO, that it was the largest one ever. It included representatives of all 28 NATO members and 49 NATO partners. Mm-hmm. Do the arithmetic. That's 77 countries as part of a global military bloc. He then talked about something called Partnership Interoperability Initiative, whereby NATO would consolidate and prolong the military partnerships it had developed with not only its 28 members, but 24 partners who sent troops to Afghanistan for the 13-year war. Now, this is unparalleled in history. We've talked about it before, but I don't think the point gets across sufficiently. Never in the history of humanity has there been a military bloc that has lasted as long as NATO was formed in 1949, that has expanded to 28 full members. There's nothing even remotely comparable to this in history. And now, with partners, includes at least 77 nations on every continent, except Antarctica. And that there's another program called Interoperability Platform that came out of the Wales Summit. And its first members are, and listen who they are, Australia, Jordan, Georgia, Sweden, Finland. Before the NATO summit, the preceding NATO summit in 2012 in Chicago, NATO launched another program called, and this is the most revealing title I suppose they could have given it, Partners Across the Globe. In its initial roster includes 8 Asia-Pacific countries, Mongolia, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan. And recently, Japan has just appointed its first permanent military representative to NATO headquarters. Several Arab countries, including Persian Gulf countries, have permanent representatives. They have missions, embassies in essence, at NATO headquarters in Brussels. You're talking about the U.S. employing the past 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall to craft history's first global expeditionary, their own term, war-making military formation. And I'm afraid the world has let them get away with it.
Well, with all those countries, Rick, it's going to be mighty, mighty tough for the rest of them to confront NATO. And as you understand very well, NATO's ambition is nothing less than to be the world's policeman. In the
Indeed.
Worst sense of the term.
Yeah, and the same Alexander Virzbal I mentioned had just, immediately after the comments he made, he had addressed a conference in Seoul, South Korea. Applauding South Korea as indispensable NATO partners participating, in the war in Afghanistan, of course, supplied military personnel, but it's also involved in what are now permanent NATO naval operations off the Horn of Africa and the Mediterranean Sea, around the world, in essence. So that what we have is, the same gangster regime, if you will, we talked about at the beginning of this program, expanding itself into an international force. And one where, I've often cited, the Aesopian fable of the mice and the cat, about the cat who picks off and devours a mouse each day, and then the mice have a council, and they decide, what they have to do about it, because they're all going to be gone in short order. I think it's a direct parallel with what's going on in the world. And that, eventually one mouse has to say, we have to put a bell around the cat's neck so we know when he's coming. Somebody has to bell the cat. Somebody has to call him out. Somebody has to acknowledge what it really is. People have to quit standing up and applauding when the head of state of the world's sole military superpower speaks at the United States Security Council. And, people here have to be far less polite and a little bit more direct in how they characterize things, which is why a program like yours is indispensable.
Rick, I must say to you, the supposed number two at NATO is a man I'm unfamiliar with, and the fact that you mentioned his name is very important. Do me a favor, spell his last name for me.
Yeah, it's Vershbow.
V-E-R?
Yeah, V as in Victor. Vershb as in boy, O-W, Virzbow. And he is U.S. ambassador to Russia twice removed, I believe. There's a new one now, and before that... McFall, but I think he preceded McFall, if I'm not mistaken. So at any rate, he's a pretty high operative if he's both former U.S. ambassador to Russia and current U.S. Deputy Secretary General to NATO. But it's historically the case where the top military commander of NATO is always an American, as we've talked about before, going back to Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the Deputy Secretary General is all, I mean, just as many of us suppose from the moment it was announced 6 years ago that, or a little more than 6 years ago, that Joseph Biden was going to be the running mate of Barack Obama, that somebody who had been in the Senate for 36 years wasn't going to be taking orders from anybody. He was going to be giving orders in the White House. Likewise, the Deputy Secretary General of NATO is a man in charge. And they can put up a Norwegian or a Dane or somebody for cosmetic purposes, but it's going to be the U.S. guy calling the shots, and he always does.
How long has he been there?
Not terribly long. I'm going to guess 2 or 3 years.
I just brought up a page with his image on it, and I've got his name. I'm gonna look up some more information on him. He sounds like a guy I have to say something about in a future article.
Actually, you'd be doing us all a great favor if you dig into him and come up with some of his connections. I'd be particularly interested in, of course, think tanks, maybe corporate interest and so forth. But yeah, you're correct. He's a high roller, and somebody should do a profile on him, and I'm sure he'll do a splendid job.
Well, the fact that he's so important, I guess he's keeping a low profile, and people like me who write about this stuff have been completely unfamiliar with him. Well, no longer, Rick, thanks to you.
It's a dubious honor to I shine a light on these reptilian creatures crawling in the muck.
Reptilian is the apt word, Rick. I mean these they're really despicable characters. Anybody supporting permanent wars and the kind of things that NATO has done for so many years, especially, well, since the 1990s, and really, I guess they're coming of age with the Yugoslav war in 1999, in the mid-90s as well, but the rape of Yugoslavia in 1999 and everything in the post-9/11 era, and it's only going to get worse ahead. This is what NATO stands for.
Yes, it does. And by the way, Virzbau's characterizations of Russian activities in Korea a couple of days ago and recently, yesterday, as I mentioned on the Pentagon website, refers to Russian revanchist Russia, yes. Russian adventurism. Can you believe, from a representative of a country that at the drop of a hat will bomb the capital city of any country in the world without even a plausible excuse, can accuse somebody else of being adventurous?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Russia has attacked nobody. The Georgia situation in 2008, the only reason Russia intervened was they were very patient. But, of course, Washington, the Bush administration, got Saakashvili, the Georgian president at the time, to send Georgian troops in and massacre people, including, as I understand, up to about 1,700 Russian nationals before Russia finally went in to protect their own citizens.
Yeah, days before the actual attack, a Russian peacekeeper, mandated by the Commonwealth of Independent States, was killed in South Ossetia. He was a North Ossetian Russian national, was killed. So, I mean, they killed Russian military personnel. But the worst of it is that the attack on the capital of South Ossetia occurred within days of a U.S.-led NATO war game. In the country where it was the largest ever deployment of U.S. Marines, at least 1,000, I forget, maybe more, and that there were still U.S. military personnel and equipment in the country when the war commenced. And then when Russia was forced to intervene, the Georgian plan was to get to something called the Roki Tunnel, block it off so that no Russian aid could come into South Ossetia. They didn't get there in time. Because of the resistance by the South Ossetians. But the U.S. then airlifted roughly 2,000 Georgian troops from Iraq, where at that time they were the third largest contingent of foreign occupation troops next to the U.S. and Britain, airlifted them back for the fighting against Russia. That means the U.S. was a party to the war against Russia, no question about it.
Oh, there's no, absolutely. America was the prime instigator, Rick.
And, of course, you have to remember the same
Saakashvili is a convenient stooge to really attack Russia against the so-called breakaway province of South Ossetia, and blaming Russia for wanting to protect its own nationals. And I forget exactly, Medvedev was president then, correct?
That's correct.
And I believe either he or Putin was in Beijing at the time because the Chinese Olympics were going on at that time.
That's right. The attack was timed to coincide with the opening ceremony ceremony of the Beijing Olympics. And we have to recollect also that Mr. Saakashvili was granted the State Department Edmund Muskie Scholarship, came to the United States on the State Department dime, studied at Columbia University and practiced law in Manhattan. So he's another one of what I increasingly characterize as American janissaries that are sent back to, you know, the traitors to their own country, who are sent back to rule their respective countries on behalf of the United States.
Isn't that the way it always is? I can remember back during the Korean War days, Rick, where I think I used the phrase that Americans parachuted in Syngman Rhee to run South Korea. I don't know whether it was before the war began. I think after World War II, he was living in New Jersey at the time. Parachuted in Syngman Rhee to be the South Korean dictator to run the southern part of the country. And this is the way America does business. Same thing in Vietnam. And if one guy doesn't do the job, get rid of him, put somebody else in charge.
Yeah, right, as in Vietnam in 1963, indeed. I mean, that's exactly what it was, right? I mean, according to Robert McNamara's memoirs, or self-apologetics, I should say, you know, he talks about the National Security at a council meeting where the order comes down to, you know, to murder Diem. And they, you know, I think Henry Cabot Lodge was the U.S. ambassador in Saigon at the time. You know, the order goes to the embassy, okay, you know, tell the military to kill him. I mean, this is all cold-bloodedly. I don't think, you know, the La Casa Nostra acts any more unconscionably than this. They probably have, you know, certain niceties or formalities they have to observe, but, you know, not the White House.
No, certainly not on a global scale, Rick, and they don't wage wars. They do it in their own neighborhoods, but they don't wage wars killing millions of people. But this is the way America operates. I think of Vietnam, Rick. I'd have to go back and look at the names again, but one name led to another, to another, to another, and even Kennedy did it at the beginning of administration until he transformed himself from a war maker into a peacemaker.
Yeah, and that was maybe our last chance, right? At least for the foreseeable
future.
Yeah,
and we know what happened to him, and the message got handed down to succeeding presidents. America's policy is permanent war. Don't you dare go against it, or you'll end up like Jack Kennedy.
Right you are, unfortunately, Stephen. Stephen, I have to ask you a favor. I thought we were going to do a 30-minute segment, and I had made arrangements with somebody else in about 4 minutes.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm sure you could fill the vacuum, but I just wanted to give you, fill the interim, but I just wanted to give you a notice of that.
Oh, when you have to run, let me know, and I will fill in the rest of the program without any problem, and I'll get back to you so we can reschedule and get you on again, Rick. Important stuff, and of course Ukraine is important because you were a contributor to the book that I edited, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. The fact that a country most Americans probably never heard of could be the flashpoint of a potential global war. That's why Ukraine is so important.
And what a tremendous initiative that is for you to pull together. And I'm accepting myself here. The stellar collection of contributors, and to put together such a diverse approach to that, and in such a timely manner. I think that's just as important. You got it out when it needed to come out, and that rarely happens in today's world. Heaven forbid we just end up a footnote in some post-apocalyptic scrawl or something, right? But I mean, you were very timely, very effective, and just a tremendous organizing job in terms of securing and recruiting.
Well, it was the contributors, Rick, like you, that really made the book. 22 contributors at all, distinguished people, again, like you, Rick, and they made the book, and we got that book out in 2 months flat. It may have been a record to get a book like this out. It really is a terrific book, and just in the last week or so, there was a wonderful book review on the book, and I was very delighted to see it. So maybe it'll help stimulate a few sales. It really needs to be read to understand what's going on in Ukraine.
No, right you are. Because without the background information, if people just walk into the cinema and they're watching a certain part of the narrative and they don't know what preceded it, not only is it easy to be confused, but it's easy to misinterpret things, even to the extent of seeing the opposite of what's occurring. And unless people have the background and the antecedents that account for what's going on, as they will when they get done reading the book, without that, it's very difficult to navigate through the reefs and shoals of misinformation that we're constantly deluged with.
Well, if you follow propaganda TV, as I like to call it, Rick, of course you get exactly the opposite of what's going on. And the Russia bashing is more intense than anything I remember during the Cold War, and absolutely irresponsible. Bald-faced lies, one after another. It doesn't matter whether you're listening to Fox News or reading the New York Times. Absolutely hideous stuff. Really outrageous.
You're correct to characterize in that manner. It really is more virulent, more unconscionable, more, you know, just nakedly brutal than anything I can remember. And, you know, we're both old enough to remember the Cold War, you know, for people listening to this who may not be. I can remember they always made a distinction between the nation and the political regime, you know, between the nation and its citizens, and not now. Now it's that, you know, if Russians, don't overthrow their government tomorrow, they're co-responsible for all the alleged egregious crimes committed by, you know, the Kremlin and as such, they deserve the same treatment. I mean, it's just horrendous. It's, you know, I don't even think Nazi propaganda, to be honest with you, would not have made some distinction between nation and people on one end and government on the other. The way it is now, it's just, it's preparing for something almost a war of extermination, the way they're dehumanizing the populaces of countries that are under the gun. I mean, this is something I think new, really. I mean, maybe we saw it with Japan in World War II, right, where, I mean, this characterization of the entire people in a racist manner. But it's been a long time since we've seen it quite as intense, I agree with you, as we're seeing right now with the Russophobia.
Well, indeed, Rick, and the problem with Putin is his independence. It's not because he's doing anything wrong. He's doing so many things right geopolitically. But his independence, he believes that national sovereignty is something inviolable. He believes that international laws mean something. He believes in these kinds of things, the exact opposite of what America believes in and practices. So the name of the game in America is regime change. They need a puppet replacing Vladimir Putin, and that's why they beat up on him so intensively. Well, thank heavens he's around, Rick.
Yeah, as we talked about before, my only objection to Putin's government is I think they've been too accommodating, far and away too accommodating. But that won't stop it. I mean, unless you're 100% compliant and obsequious, you're going to get it. 99% compliance isn't good enough, evidently. I'm afraid it's my time to run, Stephen, and I'm very sorry. I misinterpreted
things. Oh, there's no problem, Rick. We got most of the program in, and I'll get back to you, and I'll get you back next month so we can continue this.
Please, I would do it every day if I had the opportunity. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're a terrific guy. I really appreciate it, Rick. It's an honor for me to have you on. I really mean that.
Yeah, same here, Stephen. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
Bye.
And again, I urge listeners to follow the Stop NATO website. Rick really does an incredible job. He's a working guy. He spends his days working. He took a little time off to be on this program today. He does it when he comes on at other times and will in the future. But he devotes his time to keeping the Stop NATO website up to date with important information, occasionally writing an article when he's able to do it. And he does scrupulous, important research. That's why the Stop NATO website is so important. It's one I rely on all the time, and I have such great respect for Rick. We need a lot more people like him. Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, the beat goes on. The horrible beat goes on. And again, I repeat, as I've said in most everything I write about, in the articles I wrote about the U.S. elections, if anybody thinks anything is going to change come January when the 114th Congress takes over, they're living in a dream world because these wars will continue. More wars are planned. Where does this stuff end? Where does it end? The ultimate targets are China and Russia. They are the giant independent countries, and America wants regime change. It wants puppet states in all the independent countries. It's got a puppet regime in Iraq. It's got a puppet regime in Libya. It wants a puppet regime in Syria. That's what Obama's war against Syria is all about. It wants a puppet regime in Russia, a puppet regime in China. It wants countries it controls. It wants complete unchallenged global dominance, and that's what the dirty game is all about, and that's what the scoundrel media supports, plural, and that's what you get when you read the New York Times or you watch propaganda TV. You get exactly the opposite of what I call hard truths, and the hard truths are that independence, sovereign independence, is something inviolable. International law means something. Constitutional law means something. U.S. statute laws mean something, but not the way America governs. America does whatever it damn pleases for any reason or none at all. Just ram rampaging, ravaging and destroying one country after another, a phrase I use all the time because it so aptly says what's going on, and then beating up on countries that want to do the right thing, literally want to do the right thing, like Russia, repeating all kinds of lies about Russia, including annexing Crimea. Annexing Crimea? Well, the Crimeans had held a national referendum, independently judged, open, free, and fair by many, many independent monitors, and something like 97% of the Crimeans decided they wanted to return to Russia where they were before Nikita Khrushchev cut them loose. So Russia didn't annex Crimea. Crimeans returned to Russia, to their roots, where they belong. And according to international law, self-determination is an inviolable right. They had every right to do it, according to international law, but not the way the U.S. media reported. But these truths, they get buried and people don't know it. And let's say listen to programs like this, follow the independent media, other PRN programs. This is what you need to do to know what's happening in realize how the policies pursued by America, the most ruthless juggernaut in world history, literally could end up destroying humanity if a way isn't found to stop them. And the only solution is nonviolent revolution. There's no other way to do it. Grassroots nonviolent revolution, routing these people from power, putting real Democrats in power, what I call direct democracy, not representative democracy. The kind of representative democracy we have is no democracy at all. Fantasy democracy. We need direct democracy. People having a say in the way the country is governed. That's what real democracy is all about. That's the way it was in ancient Greece for a very short time. Didn't last very long, but, of course, ancient Greece was a very small place at that time. You could get the populace in a square, and people could decide what they wanted to do. Well, you can't run a country like America that way, but you can have a lot of direct democracy where people's will can literally be expressed in government, and independents can have as much of a chance of holding office as anybody from any other party. I'm for abolishing the Democrats, the Republicans, and instituting completely new parties. Going back to the beginning of the Republic, we had different parties. We had Democrats, we had Democrat Republicans, we had Federalists, we had different people. The Republican Party came into existence only a few years before Abraham Lincoln was elected president. Why can't we have a new party where a few years hence we could have a president representing a party that doesn't exist today? Wouldn't that be wonderful, providing it was a good party, serving everybody equitably? These are the kind of things we can have if we put some muscle behind them and decide we want them enough. But if we just sit back and worry about who's going to win the ball game on Saturday or Sunday, then we're going to get the best democracy money can buy, which, of course, is none at all, a hideous situation that could end up in a global conflict that literally could end up being Armageddon. And that's the risk we all face right now, a serious risk, a real serious risk. We have to find a way to stop it, or heaven help all of us. I hope I can get a chance to continue this, explain more. I do all the time in my articles. Read them. Follow me on my blog site, Steve Lenman Blog, or just Lenman Blog. See what I had to say about the elections and what a re-election is all about. A re-election is when people really have a choice to elect the people they want to put in office, not the people who are put up as pre-selected candidates, cardboard cutouts. Republicans no different from Democrats, and ordinary people having no say about anything. You know, you can choose from column A or column B, but they're the same column, the same policies, the same people. Nothing changes. Names and faces, they go around and come around, but the policies stay the same. The embedded power structure, ruining the country, ruining the world. Again, we need to find a way to stop it. Hopefully one day we will. Do listen to this program on a regular basis. I like to say make it a regular habit. Indeed, make it a regular habit. And all the program on PRN. Imagine if all programming were independent the way PRN is. Imagine the kind of country we could have with people getting real information that they need to know, understanding what's really going on, instead of the garbage we're fed on propaganda TV, or propaganda broadsheets, or propaganda magazines, big lies repeating one after another. And that's what you get when you tune in on TV or read the major newspapers, maybe some small town ones that icon name, because I don't know which ones they are. Maybe some of them are half decent, I don't know. But there isn't a big city newspaper in America or a major magazine or a major publication that isn't totally corrupted to the core, spreading big lies, telling people the opposite of what they need to know. If you listen to this program, you find out what you do need to know. And following PRN, the same thing. I think I'm out of time. John, are you on?
Yeah, I've been here for a little while now, Steve.
Oh, John, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they didn't tell you.
I got so wrapped up in what I was saying. My last guest.
Okay,
that,
that was a good one, yeah.
Well, you had to leave a little bit on the early side, so I just filled in. And I do get wrapped up in what I'm saying and tend to not pay attention to what I should pay attention
to. All right. Okay,
but,
Steve.
John, I welcome you. It's great to have you on. I know that you're so busy with your important documentary filmmaking. And, of course, you spent a lot of time in your native Australia. That it's not always easy to get you on. But it's a great honor for me when I am able to get you, and today is one of those wonderful days. You've been writing about things. Let me let you jump in and talk about the things most on your mind.
Well, I think you are just listening to what you were saying there, Steve. I agree with you about elections, and I was just thinking of the double standards that always apply. We've been there's been much concern about events in Hong Kong, about the Chinese government pre-selecting those who will be the candidates in future for the chief executive officer of Hong Kong. But that's exactly what happens in elections. Certainly in the United States, certainly where I am in Great Britain and in many other countries. And that's why there is so disaffection, so much Hong Kong-style disaffection right throughout the world. So what has happened in Hong Kong is really no different from what has happened in those that call themselves parliamentary democracies across the world. A friend of mine wrote to me today from over your way saying, oh, isn't this disappointing? Isn't this terrible what has happened with the midterm election in the Senate? And frankly, I think it's this sense of disappointment is the most disappointing thing for me. I mean, until we lose that sense of disappointment and surprise that these things happen, that we're all standing by with some divine hope that the system may change without us doing anything about it, then I think that's pretty absurd, actually. I frankly don't think it's much different. And the idea of casting Obama now as kind of helpless against this great Republican tide is as absurd. No one has pursued the extreme policies of his predecessor and of various predecessors before that more enthusiastically. In fact, with great innovation, than has Barack Obama, a man whose so-called foreign policy, it's a respectable term for really his assault on so much of the world, with the deaths of 4,700 people as the unofficial and probably real figure from Obama's drone attacks, this most comprehensive terror program that we've ever seen.
Most of it civilians, John.
Yeah, most of it civilians. But my point is that I think instead of wringing our hands and saying, isn't this disappointing, there are quite a lot of well-meaning people who really were disappointed when Obama didn't turn out as they wished. I think a sense of political consciousness really should be returned now. Obama was never going to turn out that way. Anybody that has studied or even had a cursory glimpse of Obama's record would have understood that here he was, the front man, and no different. I mean, his only distinction was that he was the first African American to become president of the United States, and that is an extraordinary historical moment. But it was a moment. And that's the end of it. So there was never really any justification for investing hope or promise in Barack Obama. And I don't think there is any reason for investing hope into any way. The system, now is working at a consistently extreme level, extreme in terms of the sort of political application, political impositions of the U.S., both at home and around the world. And it's really analyzing that, understanding that, identifying the problem. I don't think we've even really got to that stage. People are still standing by and hoping. Otherwise, there would be a massive anti-war movement, a pro-democracy movement, a pro-social democracy movement, a pro-social justice movement in the United States. And there hasn't been, because it gave up, by and large, when Barack Obama was elected.
John, I agree with you totally. It's my greatest
disappointment. And that's where the discussion is now. Not what a lot of worrying people, these Republicans, are. If you don't know that, you know nothing. It's what can be done, what kind of direct action can be mounted, but just understanding that that any kind of false faith invested in the system helps to support and justify it.
John, we both remember well the great anti-war activism and civil rights activism of the 60s and the early 1970s, and none of that exists today. And it's shocking and disgraceful where people literally do nothing, and things are worse now in terms of war in multiple countries now. And would literally, I mean, America could go to war with any country at any time in the future, but Obama has gone to war with one country after another throughout his entire tenure. All of these wars are Obama's wars, and who knows what he has in mind going forward. And the fact that Republicans will now control the Congress beginning in January, both houses of Congress, they control the House, now they'll control the Senate, doesn't mean a damn thing. The policies will remain the same. The beat will go on, and there simply will be no change on the most basic things geopolitically happening in the country and the basic things affecting Americans at home, whether it's the destruction.
Well, it's a marriage made in heaven, actually.
They've got
Barack Obama, a hawk's hawk, a man who has launched wars on seven predominantly Muslim countries. So Obama and a Republican conference, there's some rhetorical differences, but I don't see any others. It's not a marriage made in heaven for the rest of the world, of course. It's a very disastrous situation. But my point again is that we have to identify those who we invest good faith and hope in, who do not justify it, and nothing in their career justifies it. That has to stop.
Indeed, it has to stop, John, and the only way it can stop is if ordinary people decide they want something entirely different than what exists today, and it can happen, and ordinary people made it happen in the past. They can do it today, but they're not doing it. They're more worried about bread and circuses than their own personal welfare or their kids or their grandkids, and I find that disgraceful. There has to be a grand awakening, and I don't know what it can be. We had Occupy Wall Street that faded away, but we need something like that coming back on a much greater scale, with older people and younger people joining together for a country that we need to have. And the problem is that if we don't find a way to change the way things are now, we could end up in a world war. And if we have another world war, it would probably be the last one. There wouldn't be anything after that. It would be a terrible situation where we literally could destroy humanity.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. The danger of a nuclear war has never gone away. In fact, it's much more acute now when, as you were discussing earlier, the situation in Ukraine, when NATO and Europe can be so provocative towards Russia, so intimidating of Russia, and encircle Russia with troops and armaments, conduct very provocative military exercises under Russia's nose, affect the greatest military build-up in the former Soviet republics and in Eastern Europe since the Second World War, and provide that threat to Russia, a country that has been devastated by the Nazis coming through Ukraine, which means borderland across a flat countryside. Their panzers rolled in, and the result was the deaths of 22 million Russians. Not understanding that history, and then casting the Russian president as a demon, so that it's undoubtedly Vladimir Putin is an autocrat of a kind, but he is actually, in terms of realpolitik, a voice of moderation and diplomacy. I find it extraordinary that I have to point that out, not that I particularly am a fan of him or any world leader, and not one of them, but compared with the forces, the political and military forces that have been intimidating Russia, and compared with the media forces that have been inverting the truth about Russia and about Putin, there is no question that the Russian president has been a voice of moderation. In fact, so much a voice of moderation that he may be undermining his own position, because the ethnic Russian population in the east of Ukraine has a great deal of support in Russia. It would be the same as if in Britain, just across the Channel, and say in Normandy, it was all full of English people. Indeed, the British government sailed to the other end of the world to rescue, as it were, English people in the Falkland Islands. But these are ethnic Russians just across the border from Russia, when Russia and Ukraine were one country in the Soviet Union. To have the kind of manufactured situation on Russia's doorstep, it would be no different from something similar happening on the border between the U.S. and Canada, or the border between the U.S. and Mexico. It boggles the mind, the degree of propaganda these days. And I think that's our first port of call in really doing something about these situations. It's to understand, to find out. Information always remains the first power, and we must get that power first. We mustn't let extreme forces capture the truth, take it away, and give it a lobotomy and send it back as something else. That should be unacceptable.
John, I certainly agree on that. And the only good news is, based on TV ratings in America, the so-called cable news channels are losing viewers. People fed up with the stuff that they're getting on them. They don't trust them. Increasing numbers don't trust them. So they're tuning out. I guess people still watch television, movies, or whatever they watch on television. But the cable news channels are losing viewership. And there was a recent report on CNN firing hundreds of people because they simply don't have the ratings they used to have. Well, people should tune out entirely because they're not getting anything but garbage from these sources. But it's the same thing if you read the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. You get the same thing, or the BBC in Britain, CBC in Canada. You get the opposite of what you need to know. But I agree, John. It begins with understanding, knowing what's going on, and then deciding what, if anything, you want to do about it. And I always stress, for our own welfare. If we don't care about our own welfare, who will care about it for us? Nobody.
Yeah, that's right. So it does come down to a personal responsibility, but as we both know, it's only people acting together that can change things. And until movements arise that are prepared to draw in large numbers of people, as they did, as they have done in the past, and as they have done through for hundreds and hundreds of years of mass movements that have forced change, some have not successfully. I like to think that perhaps we're going through a period of perhaps disorientation. I mean, I think people are more aware now than they were back in the 60s and 70s you referred to. I think they are. I think the consciousness level is very high. But the means of doing something about it, the collective means, the political means of doing, of acting, has been taken away, it seems. And until that is reclaimed, then there won't be any change. But I do believe that the awareness is there. It's a very strange and confusing time where people know, but they don't know what to do. That happened in Europe, of course, in the mid-19th century. And perhaps there's some comparison with that time. But these days, there is an urgency, and having said that, I mean there are great actions in the world that should inspire us, and in many ways we're creatures of the censorship by omission that marks the Western media. We know little about, and therefore get little inspiration from, what has happened in Latin America, where there has been enormous changes, and right throughout the continent, various degrees of changes, not altogether successfully in some countries, but compared with what Latin America was 20 years ago. Mm. They are quite epic changes, and we and the rest of the world should draw inspiration from that. In all of the countries where there have been changes, there have been people's movements, popular movements, mass movements, that have given, for example, a country like Bolivia its first indigenous president, where indigenous people were subjected to a form of apartheid not all that long ago. Now, there's a lot that is still to be done in Bolivia, but that is an extraordinary change in that country. And there have been other changes in Latin America. So I suppose it's in those countries where people have come together in these popular movements, there has been change. And that's what has to happen. There has to be movements where large numbers of people with common cause come together. There's one immutable truth of this, that unaccountable power, great power, is always worried about what people think, always frightened about the public. That's why there's a surveillance state in the United States. It's directed not at enemies abroad, it's directed at the people of the United States.
So they're worried about that. I'm afraid we're out of time. There's so much more we could talk about, including the big differences between now and the 1960s, 70s, and why the anti-war movement really got legs then, and it's non-existent now. But we don't have time. Maybe in a future program we can talk about it. John, it was wonderful having you on. I wish you the best. I look forward to getting you back again when I'm able to do it, and follow all your wonderful documentary work. You've done such extraordinary work for so long, John. You really are a world hero. You inspire what I do, and I mean that very sincerely.
All right. Thank you, Steve. That's very good. It's a great privilege of mine to be on your show, and all power to you.
Thank you, John. Join us always on PRN and make this program a regular habit. What else?